read something from near the end of the book, which means I've got to tell you, I've got to summarise the previous 200 pages for you. So please bear with me. This novel is about two cousins called Rosamond and Beatrix. They become very close as children during the war in 1941. Then Beatrix grows up, gets married, has a daughter called Thea. Rosamond grows up, goes to university, realises then that she's gay, and moves in with her lover. This is in the 1950s. Then one night, Beatrix shows up at their flat with her daughter, Thea, her young daughter, and says, will you look after my daughter for me for a while? I have to go away. They say yes, of course. And then Beatrix disappears for 2 years. They don't know where she's gone. And during that time, they become a kind of family unit. They come to love this little girl very dearly. And then after 2 years, just as capriciously, Beatrix reappears and takes her daughter back again. Without the little girl there to kind of hold them together, the relationship crumbles. Rosamond and Rebecca split up, and Rosamond is left single and childless and lonely. Beatrix, meanwhile, has acquired a new family. She has a new husband and two more children, as well as little Thea. Everything seems to be going well for her, but then she gets involved in an accident, a bad car accident, which gives her very severe injuries. That sort of takes you up to where this passage starts. We're now in the 1960s. The other thing I should tell you is this: the narrator of this story is Rosamond, in her 70s. She's looking back on her life and telling this story for the benefit of Beatrix's granddaughter. And the reason she's telling it on tape rather than writing it all down is because Beatrix's granddaughter is blind. So Rosamond's way of telling the story is to take 20 family photographs from the 1940s to the 1980s and describe them as accurately as possible as she can for this little blind girl. And this is one of the photographs. Shortly after this 14th picture was taken, my relations with Beatrix reached their lowest ebb. I'm not sure that you could guess that, however, from looking at the five smiling faces captured here. The year is 1962, and my goodness, we look young in this picture, Bea and I. But then I realised with a shock that we were still young. I would have been 29, she would have been 32, at which age, of course, the 3-year difference between us, which seemed so momentous when we were both children, can have meant nothing at all. 29, though, is that all? A stripling I would have been, an infant, and yet in my memory, the day this photograph was taken, I feel ancient. The reason can only be, I suppose, that a cycle was coming to an end, a circle was closing. The story of my friendship with Beatrix had not much further to run. That part of me which had been tied to her for so long was about to die. Anyway, the important thing, as I must always remember, is that I describe the picture to you, that I help you to see. So let me focus my attention once more. Very well. A beach hut, painted a rich blue with the long grass of the sand dunes behind it. The thin strip of sky you can see at the back of the picture is several shades paler than the blue of the beach hut. The hut itself is a simple enough structure, just a wooden shed, really, with the two halves of the roof forming an apex at the top. Just beneath the apex, someone has painted the number of the hut, 304, and its name, Sarsaparilla, which I think means the west wind or something. On either side of the hut, you can just see the walls of its immediate neighbours. There is only about 2 feet of space between each hut. In front of the hut is a wooden platform, about the same area again as the hut's interior, and raised about 1 foot above the level of the beach. There is a windbreak set up on the left-hand side, patterned with wide blue, orange, and yellow stripes. There are 5 people sitting on the platform. Beatrix and myself to the rear in deck chairs, and sitting to the front of the platform with her legs dangling over the edge, her 2 youngest children, Joseph and Alice. Your mother, aged almost 14 when this photograph was taken, is standing to the right of the others, positioning herself between the adults and the young children. Beatrix's husband, Charles, is not in the photograph, so I assume he must have taken it. It's always possible, however, that Charles was simply not with us on the beach that day and that we asked a stranger to take the photograph. The whole of that long summer, which Beatrix and her family spent down on the south coast, he only came down to see them at weekends. The rest of the time he remained in Pinner and went to work every day in the city. I went down to stay with the family for a fortnight, I remember. It was the same fortnight that the children's nanny had herself gone on holiday to visit her parents in Scotland. It turned out that it was very much in the capacity of her replacement that I had been invited. Of course, I did not realise this at first. I assumed that Beatrix wanted my company. Perhaps my suspicions should have been aroused when I saw the room that I had been allocated. They'd taken a short lease on a delightful house near Milford-on-Sea. It must have cost them a fortune, but then I'm sure Charles was probably earning a fortune at that stage. It was enormous, with 8 or 9 bedrooms, a library, a games room, and grounds extending to several acres, which included a formal rose garden and a private tennis court, all surrounded by woodland, giving them total seclusion and privacy. As for my room, it was at the very top of the house, in the attic. It was the kind of room you might have set aside for the scullery maid. Of course, it was a privilege and a pleasure, in my situation, to be spending any time in that house at all. I'm not trying to imply that I was uncomfortable or anything like that. I'm just saying that my status from the very beginning was made very clear to me. Anyway, there we all are. The happy family, on holiday, minus the paterfamilias, but with the useful addition of the loyal family friend. I almost said maiden aunt, because that's what I was starting to feel like. Rebecca's departure, and my consequent loss of daily contact with Thea, had brought on a terrible sadness, which had long since settled on me and become a fixture. I'd grown accustomed to living with this dull, insistent pain which had a habit of flaring up, whenever I saw Thea, into something more deadly and piercing. To be readmitted into her presence was to be offered both joy and torture. Joy for the obvious reasons, torture because of the ever-present knowledge that this joy was to be temporary, short-lived. This summer I knew that I had just 2 weeks to enjoy her company. After that it would be back to London, work and loneliness. I dare say that I wasn't the liveliest company in these circumstances, but even if I was a rather gloomy presence in that household, at least there was a consistency to my mood, and children, on some level at least, appreciate that. Around me, around my melancholy, they could find stability. Beatrix, on the other hand, was volatile and unpredictable. She'd always been like that to a certain extent, but it seemed to me that her mood swings were now becoming extreme. Half of the time she behaved with a kind of desperate levity and high-spiritedness, but this could easily switch without warning into savagery. The dividing line between the two was very thin, although after a while I trained myself to observe when the change was coming. The mistake, I realised, was to leave her alone for more than a few minutes. The slightest opportunity for introspection meant that she would soon start brooding over her recent misfortunes, and then a deadly bitterness would come over her. When this happened, nobody could escape her spite and rancour. Even Joseph and Alice were liable to find themselves being screamed at, usually for some minor domestic misdemeanour, such as not picking their clothes up from the floor or spilling a drop or two of orange squash down the front of a shirt. Charles was not immune either, and his daily telephone calls would often culminate in fearsome shouting matches, during which I heard, as did the children, swear words, vile insults and obscenities, which I didn't even understand in many cases, and had certainly never come across before. Poor Charles, needless to say, had done nothing to merit any of this abuse, but it had become Beatrix's firm conviction that he was having an affair, or perhaps even a series of affairs while staying up in London without her. It was a most unlikely scenario, if you'd ever met the man. Besides being devoted to his family and a near workaholic, he simply wasn't affair material. That was my opinion, in any case. But Beatrix had somehow got it fixed in her mind that he was paying regular visits to a woman who lived a few doors down their street, a neighbour and family friend of theirs. She had no evidence whatsoever, needless to say, and whenever Charles was actually with her, the delusion would quickly be forgotten. But I came to recognise the moments when it was stealing over her, moments when she would be sitting alone in an armchair by the French windows overlooking the garden, a cup of tea in her hands, staring into the middle distance with a kind of fixed intensity. Unseeing, her thoughts roaming treacherously elsewhere. Such moments would invariably be followed by an eruption of some sort. And by now I'm sure you can guess, can't you, Imogen, who would bear the brunt of those eruptions? Your mother, of course, your mother Thea. As I said, Beatrix would scream and shout at her other two children, often for the most trifling misdeeds. With Thea, I'm afraid to say, her behaviour could be considerably worse than that. Let me tell you about one episode in particular, the episode that brought a premature end to my visit. It was early in the afternoon, about halfway through what was supposed to be the second week of my stay. Thea and I had been out for a walk together that morning, along the winding lanes which lay between the house and the sea. We'd been picking blackberries. After collecting almost a full bowl, Thea came back to the house and displayed it proudly to her mother, who glanced up briefly and muttered something, but basically didn't show much interest, even though she loved blackberries, and it had really been to please her that we'd spent so long picking them. Then after lunch, I had gone outside to sit in a deck chair and read some more of my book, while Thea went to the kitchen to start making blackberry jam. I should have mentioned that only a few days earlier, Beatrix had gone shopping and had returned with a new blouse for her eldest daughter. It was a very nice and very expensive white muslin blouse. Rather a typical gift coming from Beatrix. She didn't buy her children many clothes, but when she did, they were the very finest that money could buy and were often almost too beautiful to wear. This blouse would probably have cost more than £10, a huge sum in those days. But of course, you could hardly expect Thea or any other child to appreciate that. To her, it was just another item of clothing, albeit an extremely pretty one, and one which she was truly happy and grateful to have been given. You can see what's coming next, I imagine. Sure enough, Thea was wearing the blouse, still only a day or two old, that afternoon when she began making her jam. She was boiling up the blackberries in a big saucepan, and she had the gas turned up too high, and the berries started to bubble and occasionally spit out of the pan, and soon she had quite a few blobs of blackberry juice splashed over the white blouse. She didn't even notice it herself, as far as I know, but her mother noticed it as soon as she came into the kitchen. As I said, I was sitting outside reading at the time, so I could hear the gist of the conversation, if not all of it. "What the hell?" Beatrix shouted. "What the hell have you done to that effing blouse? I'm sorry, I cannot bring myself to repeat her words exactly." Thea must have looked down at the blouse and gasped, and then things almost immediately got ugly. Beatrix told her daughter that she was stupid, that she was the stupidest girl she'd ever known. Thea burst into tears and said that she was sorry, so sorry she would wash the blouse herself. Beatrix laughed and screamed at her that there was no point, the blouse was ruined now, and then she seized on this word and repeated it over and over, saying, "You've ruined it, the way you ruin everything, everything." And the next thing that I knew, she was accusing Thea. Yes, I heard it, with my own ears, of having ruined her health and ruined her life. "It was all because of you," she shouted. "It's all your fault that I'm like this. The accident was all your fault. If it hadn't been you that I was picking up from school." At which Thea screamed something inaudible, the words strangled by her tears, and ran from the kitchen, ran away up the stairs. Her mother's voice was murderous. There's no other word for it. I could feel at once that there was violence in the air. Bea was beside herself, completely out of control. I was shocked beyond words, but also paralysed by indecision. I wanted to reprove Beatrix for saying such horribly cruel and unjust things to her daughter, but this was not the right moment while she was in such a frenzy. To know that I'd overheard would probably enrage her even further. While I was outside dithering, in any case, I heard her yank open a drawer in the kitchen and then leave the room. Her footsteps pounded up the stairs in pursuit of Thea, and she continued to shout at the top of her voice, wicked, unspeakable words. She said that Thea had brought her nothing but pain and trouble, that she wished her daughter had never been born. I ran into the house myself and got halfway up the stairs when I heard Thea's bedroom door slamming shut and being locked. Fortunately, she could lock it from the inside. If she hadn't been able to do that, God knows what would have happened. I could see Beatrix running along the corridor towards the door then, and I could see that she had a carving knife in her hand. At once, I called out to her to stop, but she didn't hear me. The next moment, thwarted by the locking of the door, she raised the knife and drove it into the door with tremendous force, again and again, scoring deep lines into the woodwork. All the time, she was yelling at Thea to come out of there and calling her a little bitch, and even worse names, names no mother should ever call her daughter. Her 14-year-old daughter, for pity's sake. Without pondering the consequences, for myself or anyone else, I ran towards her and seized her by the shoulders. I implored her to stop, and in a few seconds the knife had been dropped to the floor. Beatrix herself turned and stood with her back to the door, leaning against it, staring at me, or rather through me. Her shoulders were heaving. She did not stay like that for long. Soon she pushed past me, hurried downstairs, and left the house. Neither of us addressed any words to the other. I think I need a few moments' rest after telling you all that. Would you excuse me, Imogen, while I turn this machine off? I think I might be in need of a glass of water. Good idea, actually. Yes, that's much better. Now I can resume. Where was I? Outside your mother's bedroom, I believe. I knocked on her door and asked if I could come in. She was distraught and said nothing at first, just threw herself into my arms and stood there, crying. After a while, I guided her towards the bed, and she lay down upon it. I lay beside her and put my arms around her. We stayed like that, I remember, for some time, until Thea had calmed down and then fallen into an uneasy, exhausted sleep. Later on, when the sky clouded over and the room grew chilly, I rose, fetched a spare blanket from the top of Thea's wardrobe and draped it over us. After that, we were more comfortable. In this way, the remainder of the afternoon slipped by. There was only one further incident worthy of mention. I opened my eyes at one point and noticed that the bedroom door was standing ajar. I'd not heard it open. I glanced across and realised that Beatrix had returned to the house. She was staring at us. All I could see of her, or at least all I can now remember, was her eyes. Bloodshot, rounded, locked onto the recumbent figures of Thea and myself with a bulbous, mesmerised fixity. The image reminds me now, more than anything else, of the character Gollum from The Lord of the Rings, with his gaze and his thoughts concentrated on his precious. I don't know why that comparison should occur to me, but it does. I hope it doesn't seem too grotesque or inappropriate. Our eyes met for the briefest of moments, Beatrix's and mine. Then she was gone, silently. I allowed my head to drop back against the pillow and was surprised to notice how fast and fiercely my heart was pounding. Slowly, as the evening progressed, the household returned to something like normality. I came downstairs and cooked supper for everyone, leaving Thea to slumber on for another hour or so. When she at last emerged from her bedroom and came down herself, the first thing she attempted to do was to hug her mother, who returned the gesture, coldly and indifferently. I flashed Beatrix a reproving look, but it went unnoticed. She seemed to have cheered up considerably since the afternoon's upheavals. I wouldn't even say that her cheerfulness seemed forced or strained. She was in genuinely high spirits, and was even jollier when Charles phoned up to say that earlier in the evening he'd locked himself out of the house and sprained his ankle trying to get in through an upstairs window. Beatrix thought this was hilarious, and for her youngest children she painted a most vivid word picture of her father's discomfort and misadventures, all of which I listened to with a certain bafflement, I must say. Thea herself did not join in. Finally, the children were put to bed by me, and the two of us were left alone together downstairs. The conversation which followed was one I've never forgotten. I had never once in my life spoken a word of criticism of Beatrix to her face. I suppose I'd always been too scared of her. Tonight, if anything, I was more scared of her than ever. Nevertheless, I could hardly hold my tongue after the scene I'd witnessed this afternoon. And so, after we'd both been sitting in silence for a few minutes, as the shadows lengthened on the lawn outside, I first of all spoke her name very softly, and then, once she had turned her head stiffly towards me, I said, "I do think your behaviour towards Thea this afternoon calls for some explanation." On hearing these words, she smiled at me, a brittle, challenging smile, and answered, "How strange. I was going to say the very same thing to you." I did not understand this remark, and I said so, adding, "After all, I was not the one who attacked her with a knife." "I attacked her door with a knife," Beatrix corrected me. "There is a world of difference. I never laid a finger on Thea, nor would I, however much she provoked me." "You intended to harm her," I said, to which she replied, "What I intended is neither here nor there. I repeat, I never laid a finger on her." There was such a strong emphasis on the personal pronoun that I immediately caught her drift, and not for the first time that day found myself astounded and horrified beyond words. "Beatrix," I cried, "exactly what are you implying?" She answered, "You know very well. You know very well that I saw you beneath the sheets with my daughter." And then, with quiet but careful emphasis, she added, "touching her." I sat there for a few seconds, open-mouthed, my mind reeling, before saying, "What on earth do you mean?" She looked at me coolly and said, "I know you, Rosamond. I know what you are. Don't think that Thea has never told me what you used to get up to with that woman when you were meant to be looking after her." And, having delivered herself of these words, she picked up a magazine from a nearby table and began to read. I got up, left the room, and climbed the stairs to my bedroom, trembling with rage. The next morning I packed my bags and returned to London. That rage has never left me, Imogen. I feel it even now. I saw on that day, that evening, what a cruel and manipulative person Beatrix had become. Perhaps she'd always been that way, and I'd been unable to see it. Once again, in any case, she had succeeded in separating me from her daughter at a time when Thea really needed me. That was a tragedy for both of us, but I didn't see that I had any choice, and I was still determined not to abandon her entirely, however hard Beatrix tried to make that happen. I'm tempted now to crumple this photograph up and throw it away. The smiles on our faces nauseate me. Well, the smile on my face anyway, and hers. None of the children are smiling, in point of fact. Thea, with better reason than most. What a deceitful thing a photograph is. They say that memory plays tricks on one. Not nearly as much as a photograph does, in my view. Let me put this lying image to one side, close my eyes, and think back to that day. What do I see? Clouds. White clouds drifting against a pale grey sky. The sky framed by the small latticed window in Thea's bedroom, at the back of that sad, beautiful house. I watch the patterns, the ceaselessly changing patterns, forming and dissolving, as the long afternoon slips away in near silence. Sometimes a cry from the garden, the sound of the younger children as they carry on with their game. Thea asleep beside me, so young, so vulnerable, so bewildered. The pressure of her body against my arm, and the cloud patterns forming and dissolving, white against grey, and the pressure of her body.